Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with Philip Cretsidamus. Phil, I just as we talked about it, I managed to mangle your name again. Phil, how are you doing? I'll give you the chance to do a full introduction of yourself and who you are, the correct pronunciation of your name, and where you're affiliated to. So tell us about yourself.
Oh, yes, sure. Well, actually, the name is Cretsidamus, but Cretsidamus is fine, too. I'm currently an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston in the sociology department, but I do work that's interdisciplinary in nature, you know, that sort of intersects with what people are doing, certainly in political science and American studies, immigration studies, which itself is interdisciplinary. I guess this book is just sort of like the culmination of a lot of different areas I've been exploring for the last few years in my work, I guess you could say. I just sort of pulled together a selection of essays which, just explore different aspects of immigration policy and politics and try to reframe them in some original ways.
Yeah, it's a really enjoyable book, I think, both for people in immigration who do focused immigration policy work, but in lots of other of the fields that you've just mentioned. I wanted to talk first about the interesting preface to the book. You describe the book in the preface as a research memoir. Mm-hmm. We don't typically think in those terms. So what did you mean by this exactly? Why is this what is in many ways, in almost always, a scholarly book, also for you a personal book?
In some ways, perhaps the autobiography really is buried, quite even. And of course, the book itself, it sort of has a broad historical sweep, it pretty much goes from mid 19th century, to the present. But I guess in some ways, I'm reflecting on issues in the book that sort of come out of my history of working with, doing immigration research, but also doing work with, immigrant organizations, immigrant rights groups and immigrant community-based organizations, the questions I'm exploring are questions that have been informed by that experience. But in some ways, of course, that really is just like the buried subtext, the actual content of the book itself is, I don't signal how it connects to my autobiography throughout. I suppose as we go on, I have to kind of explain, how each particular, section of the book has been informed, by some of that.
Absolutely. For me, it was sort of an interesting start to the book. So let's talk about the book. You begin by explaining some of the limitations of both the anti and pro sides of the immigration debate. And that's sort of not quite the right way to refer to it, but you sort of say that on these two conventional sides, there's some real limitations. So maybe you could briefly, as a way to set up what your argument is, recount what the conventional viewpoints are on immigration, both for those that argue for and those that argue against.
Yeah, sure. And I should say, unfortunately, end the book with a compelling solution. The goal of it really is just to sort of flesh out the terms of a problem, I guess the idea is really that in some ways maybe it's just best to, provide a compelling problem for us to talk about, as opposed to sort of presenting necessarily, like a tidy argument about what to do. But I'd say yes, and I guess the pro side, you could say, the mainstream, immigration coalition tends to focus on, selling immigrants, to America as, people that are economically useful. And sometimes it didn't put this in that quite vulgar way, but just maybe immigrants seem to drive the economy. Of course, you've always been historically a country of immigrants. And at the same time, there is, I've shown parts of the book, especially in recent years, especially from the 90s onwards, a tendency to recruit immigrants in ways that does, contribute to patterns of economic inequality, which quite often really harm immigrants themselves, where immigrants are recruited in ways which they are more at risk of, being you know, treated like expendable, you know, workers, sort of temporary economic guests. And of course, you know, the growth of immigration, you know, from that time onward also correlates with the, you know, the sort of expanding immigration, income inequality in the U.S. in general. So you could say that there's a, the argument for immigration is very optimistic, but it's sort of weak and passed on looking at the, you know, at the outcomes of the ethical, human, legal rights, like outcomes of immigrants themselves, and also for the, you know, the way in which income is skewed in the U.S. That's a broad way of framing it. And then, the immigration control argument, I guess one of the ironies of it, and I point this out with the expansion of immigration enforcement, is that, you know, the need to kind of, you know, secure the border and to view immigration as a kind of security threat. Ironically, sometimes it's played a role in justifying the expansion of the immigration enforcement complex. But in the book, I show that the expansion of this complex, actually, or this enforcement apparatus, hasn't really necessarily restricted immigration either. I mean, like, what would it really have been? I don't know if the government's going to officially admit this, but it's just looking at it from the outside, it appears that, the expansion of immigration enforcement had been used to control or manage an expanding immigration flow, not to really restrict the flow. I mean, certainly there have been ways in which it is being used in a very targeted way to maybe restrict certain kinds of migrant populations that are seen as undesirable, but for the most part, it's really been used to, you could say, police an expanding flow, not to restrict the flow. There's a way in which you could say the push for immigration enforcement, for immigration control, doesn't necessarily translate into lower immigration levels as well. And of course, there's also lots of arguments that have pointed out the ethical problems with just simply restricting immigration. And that's a whole other, issue there. But also, I think it's a practical illustration. I think, like, what happened the last time that the U.S. actually, explored immigration reform, the 2007 debacle under the Bush administration, and in part, what happened, in that debate was, you sort of had the, George Bush and, Ted Kennedy really coming together, to try to sponsor this sort of mainstream immigration package, that was really trying to sort of pull together, mainstream neoconservatives just mainstream conservatives who were supporting immigration reform with mainstream Democrats. But there was this ironic kind of, coalition of forces that came to oppose it, which was the, anti-immigrant groups, or the groups that wanted, more robust immigration control, and also immigrant rights activists who found that the compromises that were being made in order to sort of expand, the guest worker program and what have you, weren't really worth it when it came to, migrant rights, essentially, like things like the Z visa, which we don't have to get to in depth right now, but it was a strategy of giving, mainly undocumented workers a temporary legal status, but essentially, I'd say what some immigrant rights advocates sort of argued, I think effectively, is that it was really just sort of legalizing the very same conditions in which undocumented workers are working without really changing the conditions,
Right.
So that way of legalizing people, it was also ethically problematic for a lot of immigrant rights activists, and so it just wasn't, like you had this weird situation where you had this middle that was defined by, the kind of mainstream conservative and liberal forces, and then the sort of these odd coalition of forces against, which also spanned, you could say, like the left and right on the debate. And of course, in the end, it didn't go through because it just didn't have the support of enough of the Senate. But I think the outcome of that failed reform process and really kind of illustrates, in a sense, like the problem that I try to sort of spin out in different ways throughout the book,
Right, and we have to read this book that you've just written in the context of the current debate that's happening in the federal level. But your book, and I think this is what makes it a really interesting contribution, focuses much more on the increasingly important role played by local lawmakers and local enforcement. And the Arizona 1070 is one example of this. So where does this shift to local enforcement come from exactly? What are its implications for immigrants living in what is in many ways a patchwork of immigration laws and immigration enforcement across the country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there's probably mixed debates about where this shift, you know, like towards local enforcement came from. Like, I believe there's one person, and I won't say her name because I'm not sure if it's quite right, if it looks right, but I've heard of an argument that the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, you know, IRA, that was enacted under the Clinton administration, played a key role in sort of, setting some important precedents at the federal level, allowing for local enforcement. But the argument that I present in the book, Phil, is that, I mean, even if that might be the case, you know, that really, at least in recent years, the push towards local enforcement, practically speaking, begins around, and especially local immigration laws, really begins around 2004 or so, 2003, because you really only begin to see these laws showing up, you know, I mean, you know, on the books around that time, you know. That's something they really begin to surface, you know, and the funding data source for this really is the National Association of State Legislatures, you know, but which is what I think almost everybody uses, really. But that's where they begin to show up and expand. It so happens that expansion occurs on the heels of a failed federal level debate over local enforcement, where for a while you actually had lawmakers in Congress who wanted to pass a national local enforcement law, essentially. It would be like a federal bill that basically would have mandated local police to be involved in local enforcement. And it was resisted by a complex combination of forces, including the police departments who just thought that it was putting them in a bind, you know. And so what happened after that failed is that they began to see the rise of efforts to involve local police and immigration enforcement, but through the enactment of locally passed like of local legislatures, if you could say, you know, like a true local enforcement movement, you know, that began to happen. And really, and again, I explained in the book that basically it partly had to do with these memos that were being enacted, you know, that were circulated by the Bush administration, outside of, you know, the formal legal process, you know, like outside of the court system, what have you, but these memos that were basically revising the Department of Justice's, I guess, working understanding of the role of police and local enforcement, and especially these memos were basically saying that, you know, state and local governments and police have an inherent authority to enact immigration laws and to enforce immigration laws. I mean, you know, so, you know, like part of that time, I guess there was a body of jurisprudence which basically sort of said that, you know, police do probably have an inherent right to do so, but only in the context of, an existing criminal investigation. You know, so if you're already investigating somebody, you know, for suspicion of, you know, a crime, then it makes sense to, you know, to allow them to, you know, to enforce immigration laws in the context of that, and sort of let the Bush memos were kind of open more widely, even though there already had been some precedents that were being set by the circuit courts in the direction, but the Bush administration's, you know, memo being more clear, is that, no, police really have the inherent authority, you know, irrespective of what there's a prior criminal investigation going on or not, to, you know, so like, query people about the legal status, and local governments have the right to pass their own laws to that effect. You know, so it really kind of clarified that. And actually, this is where the research memoir comes in. I mean, I really became aware of this because I happened to be working at the time as a policy analyst and development person for the National, the Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild. And it so happened that, you know, that they were a part of a coalition of groups, including the ACLU, who actually were filing a Freedom of Information Act, query, you know, that actually forced the Bush administration to actually give up this memo, and disclose its contents, you know. So, you know, so I was sort of hearing about this as it was happening, you know, because I was working with them, you know, and that's how I basically learned about you know, but then after, you know, so I took what I learned from that and then also sort of compared it against, you know, what was happening with statistical growth of these local enforcement laws from that period on. And it's, you just sort of see that. I mean, you know, these memos are being circulated in 2001, 2002, and 2003, 2004, you begin to see the mushroom of these laws. And then they mushroom even more after the failed 2007 reform debate. And mainly, like, you know, one thing that the local lawmakers were saying was that, well, because the federal government basically hasn't solved immigration reform at the national level, then we really have to take things in our own hands, you know. And so we're going to pass our own laws to solve our own local, you know, quote unquote immigration problems, if they haven't given us a solution. And then again, then of course you see these laws expanding further after 2007. And, and they're still pretty much expanding to this day. I mean, I haven't checked the data lately, but even as of, like, you know, when this book was published in 2012, 11, 12, like, they were still pretty much going at a pretty good clip.
Right. Toward the end of the book, you try to reconcile what the country can do moving forward. You're not offering a specific array of policy recommendations, but you at least talk a little bit about this, and you suggest that this concept of whiteness is closely intermingled with national identity, and that there has to be some conversation or reconciliation about that fundamental change in the composition and identity of the United States. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and whether you're hopeful about the future for immigration policy and for immigrants and for enforcement of the laws that are on the books.
But it's, I mean, I must say that, you know, in a sense, you know, there's a point at which, I mean, I do spend much of the book just trying to sort of map out the terms of a problem, and I do, at the end of the book, there is an element to the discussion which is kind of like a big Hail Mary pass. Like, you know, I don't even know how to solve this, but, you know, here are some things we have to look at, you know. I must say, though, that, I mean, I bring a race into it, in part because, I mean, for a good part of my career as a sociologist, I teach race ethnicity classes as well, you know. So I guess I am like a critical race theorist of sorts, you know. So it's something that's sort of natural for me to go to. And actually, even in my discussion of local enforcement laws, which are situated historically, I mean, I do make the connection like with Jim Crow, you know. And it is, I mean, it's a delicate argument, because I think that, I think when you raise the issue of race, there's so much, like even with the recent, like, Martin Zimmerman, issue that just happened, the whole case happened just now. It's a hot button issue. And I think that what, for example, local enforcement shares or local immigration laws share in common, like with Jim Crow, is not the more obvious aspects of Jim Crow. Like, clearly, you know, I mentioned the book is not that local immigration laws are creating, you know, citizen-only and immigrant-only bathrooms, you know, it's not really, but what's similar is that you do have this history of local ordinances, you know, that allow localities to make their own decisions about how, you know, rights and resources are going to be, you know, organized along these, between these different categories of people, you know, and really it isn't, I mean, and actually, you know, the role that these kinds of local ordinances have played, I think, in U.S. political culture probably goes beyond even local immigration laws in Jim Crow. I mean, you could see certainly continuities, like with the alien land laws, which spread pretty much, you know, from the late 1800s and were active pretty much through the mid-20th century, which also took the form of local ordinances, and even probably an argument to be made, like the Stand Your Ground laws as well, you know, which also pretty much are state and local laws, you know, that there is a continuity in, I guess you could say, the legal rationale guiding the laws and the way in which they sort of, you know, try to, you know, create a space of discretionary authority for, like, local actors and local governments, you know, to come up with their own interpretations of, what you could say, of federal, of constitutional, you know, law and what have you. There's that thing. But getting to, you know, the whole question of whiteness, I mean, I'd say that, I mean, there's a racial dimension, you know, certainly to the immigration debate. I mean, there is research, you know, like, I mean, I've seen most recently with a book by Hatton and Williamson. We're not really where things position themselves really in the center of the immigration debate. Like, they haven't really been a hardcore immigrant rights activist, but yeah, but they cite research, you know, showing that in the case of Australia in particular, but also many other nations, that there really is a pretty well documented in public opinion, you know, empirical relationship between, you know, racial, like perceptions of immigrants as being racially culturally different and worrisome, and support for immigration reform. I mean, and support for immigration restrictions. I mean, there is that relationship. I mean, it isn't the only thing, you know, shaping these kind of concerns, but it is there, and it is something that I think we have to deal with because and start out, so that we can actually perhaps, at the very least, if we can come to terms or at least understand how that might be shaping the debate, and maybe hopefully, I don't know, control it in a more rational way, then maybe it'll be easier for us to actually get to the bottom of the more, I think, like valid economic and political concerns about the effect that, you know, that immigration has, you know, pro and con for different populations. You know what I mean? Because I didn't make the argument in the book too, which I think is also, you know, I mean, as many of the books have sort of, you know, brought this out too, that, I mean, immigration may be good for the economy, but we know that the economy in the whole doesn't work fairly for all people, you know? And so at some point, I think that it is so much that immigrants are clearly are necessarily bad for the economy, or even that they directly displace as many people as sometimes it's argued, but that, you know, that they, you know, the immigration plays a role, as do many other forces, in fueling an economic process in which the costs and benefits of economic growth are not fairly shared by a wide section of the population, right? And also where that, you know, sort of distribution of costs and benefits has become more unequal over, you know, the last few decades, you know. So immigration is really not directly the blame, but it tends to sort of aggravate these long-standing grievances, you know, that have been building up between different segments of the population about who's really benefiting, you know. But certainly, I guess, when it comes to race, you know, like race, perhaps, there's a racial, you could say, well, immigration gets easily racialized, and I think that in some ways that sort of confuses the issues at stake, you know. I know I don't really answer the question in a way.
No, I think
it's always to get to, but it's just something that, you know, that we have to. I mean, so I'm just putting out there. So, I mean, like reading the book, throughout the book, I do kind of, especially at the end, explain like why we need to like think about race, but I also try to simultaneously like reframe what we think of as race as well. You know,
mm-hmm.
Because I should also actually do this, like with another book, especially coming out pretty soon, where I deal more specifically with immigration and race, and in making the argument actually that race is a factor in immigration, it actually sort of butts heads with another way of seeing race in the U.S. It actually frames immigrant racialization out of the picture. I mean, because I think for very good reason in the U.S., I mean, we have a history of seeing race in terms of white and black, which, you know, makes sense, you know. And in terms of a history of race that is, like, specific to the U.S., you know, the U.S. political history, you know. But as a result, like, what happens is end up, like you sort of, like, it's very easy for, like, race to become, this is going to be a bit of a jump here, but, to get framed in a way that is sort of consistent, like, with, like, a Men in Black movie, you know,
mm-hmm.
where you, like, you know, like where you have all these crazy, you know, I mean, in a way, like, I think, you know, I mean, people have not begun to do this, and I always look thoughts of the Men in Black movie that are really, you know, almost maybe even perhaps intentional metaphor for the politics of race and immigration yesterday, where you can have, alien enforcement agent, you know, that's not called immigration enforcement, but that's essentially what they're doing, you know, and a black immigration enforcement agent, who are sort of these sort of equal partners, right, you know, in the project to sort of, you know, like to secure the territory. And whiteness and blackness are, you know, it's a racial difference, but it's still indigenous, seen as indigenous to the national territory. And there's all these other differences that really are just alien, you know, they're implicitly racialized because they can be distinguished from people that we see being from here, but they also are beyond race at the same time, or at least they're beyond what we consider to be familiar racial differences, you know. And so what's also tricky, which doesn't deal with tricky in this book, but, you know, but maybe just a little bit, and even bringing race into the immigration debate is how you, you know, how it begins to, like how it, you know, either intersects with or complicates this notion of just race being about black and white, you know. You know, because there's continuities between immigrant racialization and the history of black-white racialization, and I actually on this book, I focus more on that by making the Jim Crow immigration, you know, local immigration law connection. But there also are ways in which we can't sometimes see how race factors in, because we're using this paradigm of race that is sort of focused just on this understanding of whiteness and blackness, which focuses on what is presumed to be indigenous to the U.S. and actually frames out everything else that, you know, that appears to be foreign, you know. You know, and just, you know, because that isn't really seem to be part of history, you know. So it really actually is. I mean, it seems simple enough to say we should bring race and whiteness into this to think about how it's, you know, introducing these distortions into how we see immigration. But then there's also this challenge of the way in which immigration itself might force us to see race differently than what we're used to, you know.
Yeah, I think anyone hearing you talk about this subject can get a sense of how wide-ranging and eclectic your take is, and I think for those reasons it makes it a really interesting read. Before we finish up, would you just give us a little, it sounds like you've given us some hints about your next project, but would you give us a little bit clearer picture of what's coming up next, what we can look forward to from you for your next book?
Well, you know, actually, it's pretty much actually done, you know, it's just, you know, but yeah, it actually is on that topic, you know, where I'm really, really focused on the issue of migrants and race, you know, and, you know, and I basically sort of really, I mean, make the argument, what I do with this book, Immigration and Crucible, is it really is, like, I'd say four or five essays that are thematically related, but they really just kind of stand on their own if you wanted to, you know, so, you know, as distinct essays that, you know, it's just like four or five different windows into a topic. But they also are kind of little worlds unto themselves. And the next book really is, it perhaps presents more of a conventional argument, you know, that is coherent, but, you know, that really is each chapter kind of makes the same basic argument. You know, and essentially what I basically kind of argue is that there is a way in which migrants are racialized, you know, in the U.S., which is tied to a history of territory making, you know, like this process of, you know, of territory making, which sort of developed over the last 100 years, you know, but it's a distinct kind of racialization that isn't exactly the same as white and black, as black-white, you know, racialization. And it's not totally separate from that stuff either, you know, and, you know, there are continuities, and there's certainly ways in which migrants are racialized that can be similar, you know, to the way, like maybe blacks are racialized in the U.S., but there is also something different about it, and I focused the book just trying to draw out what's different about it, you know, just because that gets lost sometimes in literature, you know. So that's the basic argument, you know, and then I use it to try to, you know, rethink a lot of the issues that, you know, that we, you know, that have been explored by race theory, I guess, in the U.S.
Well, I hope you come back and talk about that book. It sounds like it might be sooner to the shelf than later. And, you know, until we get that, The Immigration Crucible, Transforming Race, Nation, and the Limits of the Law, Phil's new book, 2012, from Columbia University Press. Phil, thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. Yeah, thanks again for giving me a chance to talk.